Hello, welcome, and thank you for downloading the Missouri Review podcast. We're broadcasting from the University of Missouri campus in sunny Columbia, Missouri, home of the Missouri Review, the quarterly that brings you the best contemporary literature in fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. Every week, we'll be featuring a wide range of stories, poems, essays, and interviews from authors featured in both our print and online editions.
Today on the podcast, we'll be interviewing Micah Dean Hicks. Micah is an author of magical realism, modern fairy tales, and other kinds of magical stories. His work is published or forthcoming in places like New Letters, Indiana Review, and New Orleans Review. His first collection, Electricity and Other Dreams, was published this June by the New American Press. The first thing I wanted to ask was about the style in Electricity and Other Dreams, and I wanted to know, what is it about fables and the fantastic that is so inspiring to you?
Okay, cool. Interesting. I think, so my minor area, I'm a PhD student here at FSU, and my major area, of course, is creative writing fiction. My minor area is the European fairy tale.
Yeah.
And I've always been really interested in fairy tales, and I think at the time I was writing the stories for Electricity and Other Dreams, I hadn't actually read him yet, but there's this guy, Max Luthi, who wrote a book called, I think, The European Folktale Form and Nature, and it's all about style, like the style of fairy tales.
Yeah.
And, you know, what they do, and he talks about the sort of, like, the colors and things they're interested in, right? They're interested in, like, primary colors, red, black, white, you know, like gold, silver, like precious metal sorts of things. And the, like, sort of flatness, the matter-of-fact style, like this amazing magical thing happened, but you're going to state it as though it's not an amazing magical thing.
Yeah.
And then sort of the flatness of character, too, like characters become... not so much, you know, in a fairy tale, it's like you're reading about not, you know, David, you're reading about the prince, or you're reading about the princess, or the woodsman, or the, and people know what these kinds of people are, and so when I was putting this together, I thought, like, you know, we don't have princes anymore, but, like, I know some plumbers, magicians, and other people like that, so I thought it would be really cool to, like, make those sorts of people archetypes, or archetype, they're not really archetypes, but archetypal, yeah. So yeah, that's always been exciting to me. I've always read fairy tales, and fables, and so it seemed like an interesting thing to play with.
Stating the fantastic as reality, it seems, very Latin American to me as well. Do you think that's been... influential?
Gabriel Garcia Marquez was a huge influence on my writing. I know when I got to my undergrad, when I first went to college, I had never really read, I guess, the great literary writers, like the classics. Like, my whole literary education was, we had, like, a cheap paperback bookstore, used bookstore in my hometown, and I just, like, consumed as many fantasy novels as I could. And so I read tons and tons and tons and tons of, like, fantasy novels, some of them really great, which I still love, and some of them kind of crappy. And when I got to university, I knew that I was not going to be reading the kinds of books I fell in love with, and I was really bummed out about it. And I knew that in terms of my own writing, like submitting to contests and things while I was there, I probably couldn't write those kinds of stories anymore. And then I think one of the first classes I took was probably a world literature class where we began by reading the Latin American fiction writers, who I think are like some of the best ever. So we read Garcia Marquez, we read Borges, we read Cortázar, we read all of these amazing people. And I thought, holy shit, here are, like, these are stories, you know, set in the contemporary period, that are, you know, not about knights and princesses and castles and dragons and elves and dwarves and all those things, but these stories were amazing, and they still gave me what it is that I want from fiction. And it was really great to see that, like, to think that, well, I could, you know, do this sort of thing too. It was transformational for my writing. I think up until that point, I hadn't really written stories in that way. And what I also liked about these people is that Garcia Marquez and others are very interested in writing about poor people. They're sort of writing stories of rural poverty. Like, anything by Garcia Marquez feels like it could happen in Arkansas or Mississippi or Alabama. It doesn't feel like a story that's distant from me or, you know, it happens far away.
Right.
So those guys were really, really important to my work.
In terms of you felt like their stories could happen, you know, where you lived, do you feel in your acknowledgement section, you talk about, you think the vine-swallowed cemeteries and the fallen-down houses of southwest Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that geography has really influenced your writing?
Yeah, in kind of an interesting way. I feel like growing up, my father was in the Army, so we moved around a lot, but we always came back to Arkansas where my, like, grandparents lived, and I would spend summers with them and stuff, and so, like, most of those summers, I was just kind of by myself, unsupervised, and I could kind of root around through these old houses and, you know, find all of these old things that, you know, dead grandparents and other relatives had left behind, like hatchets and old bowie knives and, like, pieces of guns and weird things like that, and there were all these buildings sort of in decay. I think one time I found a barn in the middle of the woods that was completely grown over and, like, I hadn't known was there. So I spent a lot of time just kind of walking through the pine woods and probably causing a lot of trouble, cutting things down and building weird little obelisks out in the middle of the woods and setting things on fire. And just kind of woke up every day and did that. And I feel like the way that's influenced my imagination is through this sort of, when I talk to my students about writing, I refer to this as it's like a color palette. So my childhood is painted in, like, rusted tin and rotten boards and dead leaves and dirt. You know, all of this, like, rural poverty and decay imagery. And I feel like I do my best work when I'm drawing from that well of, like, physical objects and images, and that's what gets me most excited. And it's weird, even if I'm writing a story, like an urban, like, I feel like I don't want to get stuck doing the same story over and over, so maybe I'll write an urban story, like, in a city or something, and urban, like, writing those kind of stories doesn't come easy to me, because I've never lived in a very big place. Tallahassee's actually the largest place I've ever lived, which makes my friends from, you know, New York and other places laugh at me. They think I'm, like, Mowgli or something.
Yeah.
But also, even when I write, like, a story in an urban setting, like, in a city, it's still, like, there are, like, chipped bricks and things are kind of run down, and it's still, I think, just as sort of decayed as, like, an old patch of woods somewhere. So, I don't know, that's really interesting. It's hugely important in my writing. A friend of mine took me on a walk in one of the, like, state parks here or something a few days ago. And along this walking trail, there's, like, an old electrical substation that I guess had been packed up and moved away, but some of the pieces of it were still there. So there were these old wooden crates filled with all these metal electrical components, and they'd been kind of left to rot. And so you've got these big metal aluminum pieces in the middle of a pile of rotten plywood, and they're all overgrown with blackberries.
Yeah.
That sort of thing just makes my imagination really, really happy. Like, I feel like those are the kinds of images and objects and colors I draw from when I write stories.
I think that that's a very poetic way of talking about writing. And I even read in an interview with you on Pink's website how you talk about poetic form inspiring some of your stories. You were talking about A Famine of Music.
Oh, yeah, I think I'd been reading Guzzles or something at the time.
Yeah.
Something fractured like that.
Are there any other ways in which you feel that poetry influences your writing?
Yeah, definitely. I actually used to write a lot more poetry. I haven't in the last few years because I've been focusing on fiction. I'm kind of getting back into it now. But I know that I'm drawn to poets who do the same sort of very imagistic, very object-heavy sort of rural stuff, so I get very excited about W.S. Merwin. I like his poetry a lot. But I think poetry has mostly influenced me in terms of like trying to put together, and I don't know I don't think any fiction writer does this really well, and I think all fiction writers say that this is the kind of thing that they want to do,
yeah.
is put together very dense poetic sentences that like sentences that are short, but that there's a lot in them, right? With kind of these like striking, strong images or something. So I know that having written poetry and having read poetry has definitely helped my fiction. I'm a lot better writer because of it than I would have been otherwise.
Well, I have another question about your writing process.
Mm-hmm.
I found that almost all of your stories in Electricity and Other Dreams are built around some central moral or idea.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered whether you started out with the idea first, or you found it as you wrote.
Central, you said moral or idea?
Yeah.
Interesting. I'm not sure. I think I usually start with an image. Like, I usually have an idea for something, some weird thing. So I think with, like, Dessa and the Can Hermit, I started with the idea of, like, somebody shaking a beer can and a finger falling out.
Yeah.
And, like, added detail to detail to detail to get the, you know, sort of the plot of the story, which is that she finds this man, and then how would they interact and those other things. I think the more emotional, character-driven, like, kind of moral and idea stuff probably comes last for me, or comes hardest. And I'm still probably figuring out a lot of that stuff myself. That may not be a very good answer to your question.
No, I think that's interesting, because I felt like a story like Cleaning the Flea Boy, I felt that the moral to that story was so central, but...
Mm-hmm. That was really fun because I don't know if fun is the right word. I lived in a house in Mississippi that didn't have a concrete pad under it. It was pier and beam, and we had a family of possums, I guess, infest underneath the house and couldn't get rid of them, and they all had fleas, so fleas were coming up through the floor of the house, and I spent, like, hundreds of dollars, like, flea bombing the place over and over and over, and we could never get rid of them, and finally I ended up having to move. And so I thought, well, that would be interesting if I had this, like, character who's, like, just pours fleas off of them and they get on everything, and so I wrote the story, and I think by the time I got to the end of the story, it seemed too easy to have him cured, right? Like, I didn't want the kid to get better, like, it seemed like a central part of who he was,
yeah.
So I wanted people to, like, just love him anyway and get used to him, and so I think the moral part of the story came out sort of organically. I'm really happy with that story because I feel like it's a very weird, strange, sort of unexpected moral. I don't quite know how I would describe it, but it happened sort of accidentally, and I'm really happy with it.
Yeah, I'm happy with it too. I wondered whether you feel like you're completely committed to the aesthetic that you constructed in your first collection, or whether you feel like
mm-hmm.
flip between the fantastic and the realist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think every story in there is fantastical except for the one about all the lost loves of Danny Lowe or something, which suggests magic at the end when you find out that the girl he didn't get to have will be like, it will ruin all of the other relationships he has for the rest of his life. He's sort of cursed.
Right.
I feel like I've always thought of myself as a fantasy writer. Because that's what I grew up reading. Those are the kind of stories I love. I love what I get from magical stories. So I can't see myself really ever, like occasionally, very rarely, I'll write a realist short story if I feel like I have a way of getting that sense of wonder from it that I would want from a magical story anyway. And I read realist stories by people all the time who give me that same feeling. I just feel like usually I write magical stories. So no, I don't ever see myself writing realist work. In terms of projects I'm working on now, I have, I'm writing a young adult short story collection that's very magical, sort of about a haunted high school where there's something wrong with all of the kids. Like some of them are ghosts and some of them are different things, and it's just very crazy and magical and bizarre, but it doesn't read like fairy tales. reads like something else, and then a novel that I'll be revising soon that is sort of a mashup between ancient Greek mythology and Christian theology. So you have all of the good fathers and son conflicts, you know, in Greek mythology added to, you know, Jesus and God the Father, and it's like satyrs, and I mean, it all takes place in a trailer park around a river bottom. It's really southern and weird and dark and gross. So I think everything I write, I can't ever see myself writing a realist project of any length.
Yeah. Does your poetry sort of take on the same flavor?
Oh, that's interesting. My poetry, I think, is one of the few places where I let myself be, like, kind of real, well, really autobiographical is the right word, but I draw very heavily from the sort of rural southern color palette there also. And yeah, I don't know if I write magical poems necessarily. I haven't written what I feel like is a good poem in so long. I feel strange talking about it. I did write one. I did write one I was pretty happy with. I went to stay with my parents recently, and they live like in the middle of the woods in Patmos, Arkansas, which is like population 61 people. And there was a dog there who got snake bit. And this is kind of an odd thing to say, but for those people who live there, like when things happen to animals, usually you just kind of hope the animal gets better. It's very different than living in like a place like Tallahassee where I have friends who are very conscientious and all good people. And if anything bad ever happened to their dog, they'd rush straight to a vet and pay thousands and thousands of dollars. Whereas, I guess the culture that my parents come from, if, you know, something happens to an animal, like, you just hope the animal gets better. So this dog got snake bit, and its legs swelled up huge, and it, like, laid under the trailer for several days. Ended up getting better, ended up being fine. And I thought, well, that's kind of excellent in terms of, like, writing and poetry. So I wrote this poem called I Am the Dog Invincible about, an old farm dog that is sort of arrogant about the fact that nothing can kill it, and it's, like, eating other animals and, storming around the old farm and, nearly getting killed, but knowing that it's going to rise again.
Right.
Which was fun.
Yeah. Do you feel like you treat characters like radically different than a realist writer does?
Oh, that's interesting. I have lots of conversations with people about the difference between magical writing and realist writing, and I think I'm still trying to figure that out. I do know that for Electricity and Other Dreams, I was specifically trying to flatten my characters. I didn't want to get into character too much, like they were sort of silhouettes of people, rather than fully realized, psychologically complex people, which I think is the realist writer's bread and butter, right, is to make someone as real as possible, to make them really psychologically complex and motivated and
right.
And really let your reader, like, know everything about them, whereas, like, I think I have a lot of characters in Electricity anyway that are just caricatures or silhouettes. They're sort of standing in for an idea sometimes. So I think that is something that magical writers maybe get to do that realist writers don't get to do. I can't think of any realist writers I've read that do that sort of thing, that are writing with very flat people. Amy Bender has a cool essay in, I think it's the Tin House Writer's Notebook. I think it's just called Character Motivation, where she sort of talks about the same thing. And she feels like in a magical story, all of the crazy magical things in the world that are happening, all of the magical setting stuff, she argues that that is character, like that tells you what's going on in the character's head, which I think is interesting. I'm not sure I completely agree with that all the time, but I think it's a cool idea.
That is interesting. Sometimes I feel like you can tell me if I'm completely off base, but I feel like your characters are like serving a purpose almost.
Oh, interesting. Like, what do you mean?
I guess serving a purpose for whatever message you'd like to get across. Again.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Again, I'll bring up cleaning the flea boy.
Uh-huh. Right. Right.
Just because they're so flat, and also railroad burial.
Right. Interesting. I feel like I never really think about moral and message at all, which is not to say it's not there. It's just not something that, especially early drafting, that I work for that much. So I know that the ending of Cleaning the Flea Boy came out very sort of like it feels like it has a lot of moral force. And I think that to me, a lot of that was just that I knew the ending of the story had to be unexpected. It had to be something the reader didn't see coming. Like, I think we have a fiction professor here that says, and, you know, as you're ending a story, the reader will expect this thing to happen, you know, thing one to happen or thing two to happen, and you have to give them thing three.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking about just a strange way to end the story that would be a little different and unexpected, and that no one would see coming, maybe, where the town all comes together. You expect they're going to persecute the person, and then they want this person.
Yeah.
So I hadn't thought about it in terms of, like, moral or message. I think that's really cool. I probably should think about this a little more. And I think with some stories, too, like the Railroad Burial you mentioned, a lot of that is sort of trying to skew the world and make it very strange, and like putting I feel like songwriters are really awesome at this, and I'm kind of jealous, where they'll put together collections of images and phrases that are really resonant, and they sort of force the reader to make meaning out of it. There's like enough mystery there that a reader can fill in the blanks and make it mean. You can sort of hang all of your problems on a good song and feel like it's about you.
Right.
And I feel like that was maybe the kind of thing I was trying to do in Railroad Burial. Like, so I wouldn't be able to articulate what I think it means. I was just trying to, you know, collect some images and some ideas and see what would happen.
I'm gonna ask you. I'm gonna move away from your style now and ask you what the process of putting your first book together was like.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
In terms of.
Yeah, I can just talk about that. Or do you have specific questions or sandbox?
No, just general.
Okay, general. So when I got to I did a master's program in fiction at the University of Southern Mississippi, and I knew that when I arrived, I wanted to come out on the other end with a book. I knew that I didn't want to just do, like, here's a story about a duck, here's a story about a ghost, here's a story about this. Like, I wanted to have some kind of cohesive collection, so before I got to the program, I was, I had read all this Garcia Marquez, and I had read all these fairy tales. And I was starting to get very comfortable with my own Southern writing, and I thought I want to do a collection of that kind of thing, like Southern fairy tales and fables. And so that's all I ever wrote the whole time I was there. So every story that I turned in for workshop was me working on this problem. And I think it was very good for me because the first semester I was there, semester and a half, I wrote really shitty, terrible stories.
Yeah.
But I think all of that was very, they're all stories of the same kind, toward the same project, and I think writing those stories so badly helped me figure a lot of things out, so that when I wrote one story and I felt like I'd finally gotten it right, the first one I think that I felt like I got right was Old John's House, was one of the stories I turned in for workshop, and once I got that one, I thought, well, now I kind of know what I'm doing, like I want a collection of stuff that feels like this, or as much like this as I can, and then it went pretty fast after that, and I was just kind of writing them and sending them out everywhere in the world. Was really pleased to have them accepted, some of them accepted. And then, I guess, right after my thesis defense, which was early in the spring of my last semester there, I revised it based on my thesis committee's comments, and then I immediately put it in the mail. I sent it to literary agents,
yeah,
not really knowing that they didn't want to touch a short story collection usually without a novel behind it. So that was good for me to learn about the process of sending to agents, even if it didn't really go anywhere. And then sent to a lot of book contests and a lot of indie publishers and things like that. And it was funny because I would send it out like maybe 10 places, 15 places, and then feel terrible about it and think the whole thing was a mess and it was garbage. And I would radically revise the whole thing. I would move stories around. I would play with the sections.
Yeah.
Send it out to another 10 or 15 pages. And it would take about 3 or 4 weeks to feel like really, embarrassed over it again. And so I did that like 5 times. And then the funny thing was that one of the first people that I sent it to ended up accepting at the New American Press, their fiction contest. So I'd revised the damn thing like 5 more times. After they'd taken it, which was nice. It needed the revision.
Revise, like, the structure or the...
Yeah, both the structure and the stories. Like, I would just print out the entire manuscript and sit down with a pen and start going through it again, you know, line by line, and sort of thinking about story structure, and send it to friends who are, you know, good readers for me to get, you know, like, there are many of the stories that I had sort of feelings that something was wrong, but I didn't exactly know what, so I'd send it to, you know, good friends, and you know, get a fresh pair of eyes on it and see what they thought. And some of them ended up being very, very different. I'm trying to think of a good example. The Hairdresser, The Giant, and The King of Roses is a complete rewrite of the version that it was when I sent it out for publication, when I sent it to the book contest. I disliked the story so much that I started from scratch with some of the same ideas, and rebuilt it from there.
So do you feel like the structure of your book is still fluid, or do you think that this is the... structure that is right?
Yeah, I think the structure is finally right. I had arranged them with these sections, Bone Sparks, Chimes, Thorns, when I send it. I had just those four sections when I sent it out the first time. And then I ended up writing a lot of weird animal stories.
Yeah.
And they weren't fitting too well in any of the other sections. So I thought maybe they needed, and I negotiated that with the publisher afterward, but, you know, I had these, you know, five or six more stories that I thought were fun that I wanted to include. And I was surprised that he wanted to actually lead the collection with those. I'd originally kind of put those at the back because I thought maybe they were goofier or less serious. I wasn't sure how people would receive them. But he wanted to lead with the animal stories because he liked them. And so, yeah, I feel like this is pretty much set. I like the kind of symmetry of it, how each section has basically the same number of stories. And I like having it divided up like that. And I'm pretty happy with the order, so... Yeah, I feel like this is how it should be.
Yeah. Well, I guess, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you want to touch on?
Let me see. I think we've covered everything. Something that I thought was kind of interesting, just in terms of the sections themselves, Bones, Sparks, Chimes, Thorns, Scales. Okay. Scales is first now, but it doesn't matter. I think Sharon Old's poetry collection, Blood, Tin, Straw, where she did something like that. And I got really excited that she was dividing her poetry up, not in terms of, like, idea or in terms of theme, but in terms of image. And that was really exciting to me. And I thought I kind of want to do that same sort of thing. And so I ended up just taking that idea from her, and that's why I did it the way I did.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting, too, because I don't know, I've just been, I'm fairly new to the whole literary scene, and I'd seen, like, the divisions in poetry collections, but I hadn't seen it before in short story collections, and I thought it was a great way to look at the collection.
Oh, cool. Thank you. I wanted it to feel like, I feel like it's hard with a short story, like with a novel, it already feels like one cohesive project. And I feel like sometimes I read short story collections, I guess it's the same with music albums too, you have like a collection of random tracks. I didn't want it to feel like that. I wanted it to feel like a series of movements, like you were kind of moving from one kind of thing to another. I wanted it to feel very cohesive, like it was one whole project.
Yeah.
So I think that made it fun for me, hopefully fun for the reader, but yeah, I had fun putting it together like that. Oh, and I guess the last thing I wanted to say is the artist that I work with, Liz Green, did such an amazing job on the cover. Like, she really, really blew me away. I wrote to her and said I wanted, like, a satanic altar of junkyard crap with, like, deer antlers in it and wrecked cars and all covered in vines and shooting sparks and all messed up, and she's like, no problem, got it, and she really came through. I think it looks great.
Yeah, it does look great. So are we, is there, what should we look for next from you?
This is kind of fun. I have a fantasy novel, like I guess it's a sort of a young adult fantasy novel that's my version of the Alice in Wonderland story.
Yeah.
My agent is shopping at the publishers now. So I don't know if that's going to happen or not. Fingers crossed. So she sent it out to, I think she sent it out to like a dozen this first round. We've heard back from some very positive rejection letters, but there's still plenty more to hear back from. And I guess if no one takes it, I might revise it and try that again. So I know, I feel like that's on the horizon. But more recently, this young adult short story collection I'm working on about the magical high school. I've been sending those stories out and writing them and have gotten a few published. There's one in the New Orleans Review online recently, and I'm really happy with that story, and it feels like what I want the whole collection to be. So I guess in terms of what's going to be new popping up for me, it would be those stories, probably in just different online magazines for a little while. So those are the things I'm working on now.
All right. Well, thank you for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you. This was really fun. I appreciate it.